and you just feel like you're running from minute to minute. This was one of those weeks. On Monday, my class at Montana Bible College had its final exam. And they all gave their oral presentations of their exegetical papers, which then I had to grade all of those oral presentations, and then I had to grade all of their exegetical papers, which took considerable amount of my time, especially since I hope none of them are listening to this, I'm coming to the realization that somewhere along the line, we have forgot how to teach children how to write. They don't know how to write anymore. And so it's like, wow. And then of course, just like I did with my own children, except for now there's 10 of them there, I can't read a paper without correcting all of their mistakes and writing notes in the margin saying, you can't start a sentence with which. That's a clause, you know, and all the way through. So it took me forever. And then on Tuesday, I had forgot that I had volunteered to cook lunch for the Deer Lodge Ministerial Association, and we met here at the church. And so I was running to do that on Tuesday and getting the music out for the church service on Thursday, which of course this week was an additional thing that we have. I had something on Wednesday too, but I'm forgetting it right now. But then Thursday, of course, we had our day of prayer, National Day of Prayer service that we did here at the church, which was actually really nice. I'm glad that I think we had 12 people come out to it, plus myself, so 13 of us here, and had a great time of prayer and worship, and but just really a good time. And then Friday was the graduation for the college. So I had to drive back over to Bozeman, spent the whole day at graduation in Bozeman, thinking, well, that's okay, I'll get my sermon done on Saturday. Till I remembered that we had a work day all day Saturday. And so I couldn't let all those ladies, you know, come here and work so hard while I'm standing around preparing my sermon. And so we had work day yesterday, and I will be honest with you, I did not get the time I would have liked to have gotten in preparing this particular message on this passage. I've been reading it throughout the week, and there are several things that has really hit me, and I just thought, let's just read through it. And let's just talk about some of these verses and some of the wisdom that this woman is giving her son, and even how we might be able to apply it today, because sometimes it doesn't apply directly, I think, in the same way she's using it, but I think there is an application when we think about it. So let's begin with chapter 31 in the first couple of words here, the words of King Lemuel. So Lemuel writes this down from memory of what his mother had taught him. So let me just say something to the sons. By the way, I do believe this entire chapter is not written to women. It's actually written to young men. I think the idea, and much of Proverbs is directed right towards young men, trying to gear them and put them on a particular course. And so chapter 31, I think that's the focus here. So this is not something, and the reason why I say that is as we read it, this is not so much putting this ideal woman in front of women and saying, okay, you need to be like this. That's not really what's going on here. I think what's really going on here is a mother saying to her son, this is what you need to look for in a woman. And this is what you don't need to look for. This is what you need to avoid. And this is what, son, if you don't have this, you're going to have a hard time finding wisdom. Because without an excellent wife, and without a most excellent wife, wisdom is tough to get your hands around. And in fact, as we come to that portion of this passage, it really strikes you that, wow, this woman is reflecting all of these different aspects of wisdom that the book of Proverbs has been putting forward throughout the entire book. You know, just as an example of one, but there's many. Proverbs has a lot to say about idleness. Well, let me tell you, show me an idle moment in this woman's life. There is no idle moment at all. She is the epitome, the ideal of the hardworking person. So the first thing I want to say, though, comes from the first line, an oracle that his mother taught him. Well, he must have been taught well by his mother, because somewhere down the road, he was able to write it down. In other words, what's it tell us right off the bat? That he listened. That he listened to his mother. And that her teaching laid such an impression on him that once he had become king, which I'm going to assume is farther down the road, he still remembers the words of his mother. They are still impacting how he is living. In fact, I'm going to just speculate a little bit. It's a little speculation, but I'm going to suspect that if King Lemuel would have ignored the words of his mother, he probably would not have repeated them for us here, because it would have indicted him. So, for example, one of the first things she's going to say to him is warn him about women. Now, remember, he is a king. And we're not sure exactly where he was a king. Sometimes we take the meaning of the word, and right now it's escaping my memory what the meaning of Lemuel is. And sometimes Lemuel may just be a way of referring to another king. Some suggest it refers to Solomon. I doubt it if it refers to Solomon. For one, I don't think Solomon learned much wisdom in this area. He had a lot of wisdom, but he certainly didn't take these words to heart, especially the first one. Because her first warning to her son is, which is a great warning for kings, and her first warning is, be careful in terms of giving your heart to many women. Because that's the problem kings had in their day. So what does she say there? What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, plural. Do not give your strength to women, plural. Your ways to those who destroy kings. Some believe that Lemuel, because of a way of translating something, is the king of a place called Massa. Massa is just to the east of Israel in the Arabian desert area. And that he was probably, remember, Solomon's kingdom has expanded greatly and includes a lot more than just Palestine. So it's very possible that this is one of those kingdoms that have been incorporated into Solomon's kingdom. And these people are now being affected very much of the God of Israel and Yahweh. And I bring this up because, of course, in those kingdoms, much like Solomon's own kingdom, almost every king had a harem. And the first piece of wisdom that his mother gives him is, that won't serve you well. That will not serve you well. Maybe she spoke from experience because she would have been the queen mother. And maybe she knew the problems that a harem created in the life of her own husband. And so one of the pieces of advice she gives her son is, hey, don't give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. It does make you think it's coming after the time of Solomon, doesn't it? Because who can read those words without thinking, like Solomon did? Like the mistake that Solomon made, who wrote many of these proverbs. But as wise as he was, he still played the fool when it came to his harem. And those women destroyed him. And here this woman says to her son, don't follow in Solomon's footsteps. That'll bring destruction. Well, I think there's probably a lot of mothers today that have given that warning to their sons and probably continue to need to do so, that be careful. Give your heart to the right person. Don't just give it to anyone, because that can be very destructive. And what's the second thing she says, which is interesting? We quote it in a lot of different contexts. It's not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. So what's her wisdom here? Lemuel, my son, you're going to be a king. You're a king. You cannot afford to be under the influence of something other than your own faculties and the Spirit of God. You can't afford it. Why? Because so many people are dependent upon your judgment, upon your decision making. And so she consequently warns him about this. Now, you think about this in ancient times, there was probably nobody that was going to be drinking more than kings and the people of their household. So this mother is going against all of culture here when she tells her son, you need to avoid this. Guys, that's quite a bit of wisdom. Because the reality is, you're not going to hear this anywhere else. There's almost no place you could go on the earth and hear those kinds of words spoken. I'll be honest with you guys, as I read the Old Testament, I'm not sure you can find that many Jewish people saying those words. And here this woman says to her sons, son, listen to me. Do not allow yourself to become under the influence of anything else, because people are relying on your good judgment. Notice what she says next, and we quote this sometimes in the context of Good Friday and Jesus' death. She then says, give strong drink to the one who is perishing and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty or their circumstance and remember their misery no more. This is often why, and we see this at Good Friday, that they offered wine to Jesus in his distress. They used it sort of as a form of a numbing agent, and maybe even like what we would use morphine for. You might call it comfort care. This is a part of ancient comfort care. That's the purpose of wine. So she doesn't dismiss the idea that God has given alcohol for a reason, but it's not for kings. At least the drinking too much of it is not for kings. But there is a place for it, to help the person in that midst of their suffering, to forget that suffering. Interestingly, Jesus, when they offered him that wine, he refused it for the very same reason, right? Because he's a king. And he did not want to lose any of his sense of what was going on. He did not want to have the pain numbed. He did not want to have an unclear head. Consequently, he follows the advice that the mother gives to her son, Lemuel, and refuses it. Is there an application to this? Well, I think there is. And I think there's an application to us as Christians. And I'm not getting into whether or not Christians should drink or not, but I am going to get into the issue of what she's getting into. Should it ever be at a place where it is actually affecting the way we think? No, it should never be. And here's why. Notice what she says here. Because you're a king, you have to have your judgment with you at all times. Well, guess what? You may not be a king, but you're the son of one. And you're his ambassador. You're his representative in this world. And I think the mother of the mule would say the same words to us who are the ambassadors of Jesus Christ. Wine and alcohol, for the purpose of numbing your thinking, of letting you forget things, of any of those kinds of things, that's not for you. That's not for you. That may be for people who are in poverty, but as we learn from Ephesians, we have been blessed with the riches of Christ. That may be for people who are in the misery of their sin. And I don't think she would advise that, but I think she'd say, I understand it. So in other words, this is what I think she would say to us today, especially to me living in Anaconda. I understand why so many people in Anaconda have a problem with alcohol. Because their lives are miserable. Because their lives are in pain, maybe self-inflicted misery, self-inflicted pain. But they want to forget. I can see why they have an issue with that, because I can understand why they would want to forget this life. But you know Jesus. You have the life of Christ. You have been given a task that is just unbelievable as his ambassador. Some of you are called to be mothers, an ambassador of Jesus Christ to your children, and fathers, ambassadors of Jesus Christ to your family, as we saw in Ephesians. You have a life, you have riches, and you have blessings. Why in the world would you want to forget that? Why in the world would you want to numb your thinking when God has given you this? In fact, I think what she would say is, when we as Christians ignore this advice and we drink too much and we allow it to have that kind of effect on us, you know what the world is saying? They look at that and say, well, I guess he doesn't have that much of a life that I would want, because he has a life just like mine and he wants to forget it. He wants to numb it. And I think the mother of Lemuel would say, that's not for you. Not for my son, and not for the sons of God and his children. Not for his daughters either, because we have been given this life. I think that's the application of this passage. And then I like she turns to, since she has brought up these people in poverty, since she's brought up these people in misery, one of the reasons we need to keep clear heads is because we need to speak for them. We need to advocate for them. We need to help them. Verse 8, open your mouth for the mute, the one who cannot speak for himself or does not know what to say, the one who doesn't know how to pray for themselves. They don't know who to pray for or who to pray to. And in the king's case, who are so destitute and can't stand up for themselves, open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and the needy. One of the reasons why we need our faculties about us is because we are called to advocate, to help, to stand in the gap for those very people that are trying to forget their lives by drowning themselves in drink. We're called to speak for them, not judge them, not condemn them, not turn against them. But their destitution, Tom, comes from their own sinful choices. Yeah, well, I'm sure the destitution of people in this day came from sinful choices. But the king is called to speak for them, to give them justice, judge righteously, and defend their rights, protect them from even their own folly. And if that is true of a king in the days of Proverbs, it's true of the sons and daughters of God today. And then I think she turns. Now, a lot of people would disagree with this. Some people would say this last thing is just attached onto the end of the book of Proverbs. It is not Lemuel's mother still speaking. But there's nothing that would indicate a change in speaker, and it seems like an appropriate thing that a mother might want to say to her son. An excellent wife is hard to find. Here's what you need to be looking for. And maybe she has a woman in mind, maybe she has herself in mind. Or maybe she has a woman that she's already picked out for her son, and said, that's the one that will fulfill these kinds of things. I don't know. Sons, pay attention to your mother's advice when it comes to the women you should marry. Look at what she says here. An excellent wife who can find. She is far more precious than jewels. Could be the word rare, actually. Not so much precious, but rare. In fact, let me just say this up front. This woman is the ideal wife. And often we are told as pastors, you should never preach on Proverbs 31 on Mother's Day. Do you know that? I don't know if you guys knew that. But we learned that in seminary. Never preach on Proverbs 31 on Mother's Day. You're just going to make all the women of your church feel bad about themselves. However, no one has ever told me, don't preach on, you know, the qualities of Jesus as a husband of the church on Father's Day. No one's ever said that. And it's really the same thing. I don't think it's wrong for us to lay an ideal out before us. Just as we lay Jesus out as our ideal, knowing that, guys, none of us are that. But that doesn't mean we don't need to look at that and say, but this is who we should be. This is what we're called to be. I think this is what this woman is. She is an ideal. She's rare. And the author recognizes this. This one is going to be a hard one to find. This one's pretty rare. And the point is not, you know, don't marry anyone unless you can find someone with this ideal. The point is, these are the qualities that we should aspire towards if we're women. And these are the qualities that a husband should look for in a wife. Now, no one's going to have them all. No one's going to be like this woman. She's incredible. You know, she is sort of Jesus incarnate in a wife's body as she sets this ideal. And she is rare, more rare than jewels. And the heart of her husband trusts in her. And he will have no lack of gain. This actual verse made me pause because when I thought of Ephesians, I usually think this way. It is the wife's job to trust in her husband. It is the husband's job to love and provide for his wife. Isn't that the way we've all been taught? Husbands love and provide. Wives receive that provision and trust in him. And we might use the word submit with our new definition, which is an old definition that Jesus gave it. However, when you read this chapter, it seems like they got it backwards, didn't they? The husband trusts in her, and she seems to do an awful lot of the providing. There is a lot of provision that comes out of this. So apparently, and this woman is being set forth as an ideal, so maybe our understanding of, boy, men need to be the providers of a family, that's a miss. And part of this comes from this, and I think it comes out of this passage. Let me say it this way. The ancient world had no concept of a housewife. That's a 1950s concept. A 1950s concept of a housewife is not, it's foreign in any ancient society. For this reason, in an ancient society, it took everybody in that family working their tails off just to survive. Children, wives, husbands, if they had servants, extended family, grandpa and grandma. Guys, no one was sitting around doing nothing. Everybody was working for the survival of the family. There was no concept that one person works and the other person sort of maybe tends and takes care of a few things around the house. The closer thing that we have to this is just go back, probably even to this day, just go on a farm. Go on a farm and tell me what a farmer's wife looks like. Well, I can guarantee you this. She doesn't spend her day just dusting things off in the house. Because farms don't survive. Family farms don't survive unless everybody on that farm is involved in its success. Well, that's ancient life. And that's where the writer, and this is where this woman is coming from. It's where their whole culture was coming from. Everybody's got to be involved. And so right away, he says the heart of her husband trusts in her. He cannot afford not to trust in giving responsibilities to his wife. He can't afford that. They'll all die if he's not willing to give responsibility to her. And he does. And then this very interesting line, and he will have no lack of gain. Because that's not really what it says. And we don't really translate it the way it's written because it doesn't seem to fit our thinking about women. I was trying to think of a modern equivalent, and we really can't. I could go back about 20 or 30 years, and I could use a phrase something like a coupon warrior. Now we're getting a little close. You see, because what the line he uses here is, and she will bring in for him plunder. He trusts in her, and she will bring in plunder. Plunder? Yep, because she's being described as a warrior here. She's being described as a person that doesn't just sit around waiting for things to come to her. She's going to be described as a person who is out there gathering and bringing in. And the word, the Hebrew word, plunder, it's used consistently throughout the entire Old Testament. It's the idea of that which one takes. She goes out and she gets it and she brings it in. Now, I think it's being used metaphorically here. I don't think it suggests she's going out and raiding her neighbor's, you know, pantries and bringing back food from places like we normally think of plunder. I think it's being used metaphorically with this idea that like a warrior, in many ways, thinking like the husbands, like a warrior, she is out fighting for her family. That's the image it wants to give us. You need to find a woman, son, who will fight for you and your children. She will fight for your survival, and she will be out and about, and we'll see in a minute all the things that she's doing, but she will be out and about, and she will be gathering in, fighting for you, and bringing in profit and gain, and that which is needed for the care of others. And that's why I think he refers to it as plunder. She goes out and brings in plunder. Verse 12, she does him good and not harm all the days of her life. And maybe this mother just slips this word in and isn't thinking much of it, but I can't imagine she put all the days of her life without a thought towards the problems with many of our relationships. That we might find a person that's willing to do that for a while. But are we willing to find a person that is going to do that for all the days of our life? Remember, it's the ideal. But the ideal is, this is a person who's willing to do this all the days of her life. The mother of this son knows that's what he needs. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. This sets up what's going to come in a minute about how she makes clothing for her family. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. Can you not just picture this? I mean, this is not the modern day where she knows where the local grocery store is and she goes down and gets everything she needs and brings it home. That's just not the ancient world, right? How are you going to bring home all of the things that this extended family is going to need? Well, she spends her day in search of different places where she's going to get different kinds of food. She's going to trade with people. She's going to gather food in some places. And the idea is she's like a merchant. She's going from place to place to place, bringing home goods to her family. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. Let's start with she rises while it's yet night. I can't read this without thinking of my wife. My wife is always up before me, always. And no matter how early I try to get up, if she hears me stirring, she jumps out of bed to get up before me. If she senses that I'm getting up, she's up. And never, I'm trying to think, I can hardly remember a time when my wife was in bed and it was light out. It is always when it is dark that is she's getting up. And this is how this woman is described. She doesn't want to waste any daylight. She's up before everyone. It's still night outside, and she's providing food for her household in portions for her maidens. Does that mean she's making breakfast for them? It could, but it's probably more likely that she gets a very early start on gathering in the needs for her family. And then it mentions, and portions for her maidens. Now remember, this is a queen mother talking, and she's talking to her son. And she's talking, I think, to a son who's going to be marrying a queen. And so this is a pretty big household. And part of their responsibility is not just going to be their own children or their own family. They are also responsible for many other people within their household. And this excellent wife, at least in the words of a most excellent mother, is a person who recognizes their responsibility to meet the needs of those beyond her family, but those who have been put in her care as a queen. That's who these maidens are. Well, I think there's some application to that. That I think it's saying as the ideal, and I think this is true of husbands and wives and families in general, especially Christian families, we should never seek merely the provision for our own family. We should always be seeking to bring about provision for our family and whoever God has put in our care. That's why, remember in Ephesians, it tells the thief, you need to work hard. Why should you work hard? So you have something to share. With who? With other people in the congregation who have nothing and may be tempted to do what? Become a thief. So you need to not only stop being a thief, you need to become the solution for thievery. You need to work hard and be willing to share some of what you have made so that others are not even tempted into thievery because they have nothing. You need to become the solution to the problem. And I think this woman is saying, that's the kind of woman you need to find, son. You need to find somebody who works hard and sees her greater responsibility and provides for beyond her own family. And we'll see this coming back a couple of different times. Verse 16, she considers a field. I bet this surprised some of you that were thinking as you read this. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. She must have her own checking account. What's going on with this? I wasn't expecting this in an ancient text. Women don't buy fields, do they? Women are not the ones that go out and look at a field and say, you know what, I think this is pretty good ground. I think we could do something with this one. But she is. In fact, this mother is saying, you need to find a wife who can, she's got a head on her shoulders. She makes good decisions. She can evaluate things and determine what's worth something, what is not. And that she can see a field and say, I can do something with that. And that not only does she buy the field, but the whole point here is, and she plants the vineyard. And she brings forth fruit from that vineyard from her own resources. She's doing all of this from her own resources. That's how industrious she is. And she dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. You know what the phrase actually is here. Also is in Ephesians, right? In a few other places. She dresses herself with strength. She girds up her loins. We just don't like that King James phrase because we don't really, it's a weird sounding thing. She girds up her loins. What's that talking about? Well, it's the same thing it's talking about in most of the places it's used metaphorically when we gird up our loins. When do you gird up your loins? Well, one is when you're going to run, when you go into battle. See, once again, she's being described as a warrior. She's a warrior for her family. She girds up her loins, which means she's getting ready to work. She wants nothing that's going to get in the way, no obstacles. She's gonna tie up her garments and get to work. She is a woman who is not afraid to get her hands and her feet dirty. That's what this is saying. She's ready to work. And I think the NIV actually probably brings that out a little better than the ESV does in this place. So she dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. This is the second line in the chapter that I thought of my wife. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Mary has an incredible knack of recognizing value in something. Things that I find little value in at all, sometimes I just consider it junk. But she will see value in things that I don't see value in. And eventually, it often proves to be true that it has value. I'll give you an example of one I just learned recently. She loves this tin stuff that's just old, rusted, broken down, crummy tin. That's been on, sheds that probably were put on, their cabins 100 years ago. You know the kind. You're walking through the mountains. If you get up and hike in, or you're driving your little side-by-side, you'll see it sometimes laying on the ground. It's that corrugated little tin. It's been there for 100 years and rusty. Okay, you know what I see there? I see trash. I see garbage. She loves that stuff. So we could be walking through the woods, which is a real pain, I might add. And she sees a big sheet of the stuff. It's like, we got to carry this home. And I, the whole way, I'm thinking, oh, brother, what is this even good for? So we have some of those sheets, and we end up using them. I'll put them down, and we'll put my wood on top of it so that it keeps it off the ground. But that's not what Mary's thinking. And just last week, Daniel was up at our house, and he saw in our neighbors a pile of this exact stuff. And he says to me, do you think you could ask your neighbor if I could buy that from him? I'm like, buy it from him? My wife has me gathering that garbage all the time. Oh, no, man, that stuff is incredibly valuable. I'll pay him good money for that. I want to put it on this shed that I have, because it just keeps that old look to it. See, she sees value where I don't see it. That's this woman, right? Isn't that what that this woman does? She recognizes the profit in the things that she has. She knows when she's got something that's worth something, and she knows how to use it for the benefit of her family. And then it adds again, not only does she get up early, her lamp does not go out at night. She works late. And it tells us what she's doing working late. She puts her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She's making clothes for her family. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. And we'll see this in just a second. But what it's suggesting is that she stays up late and she makes clothes, but she makes more clothes than her family actually needs. So she ends up selling some of it. And then she takes that, not to make herself rich, but just like in Ephesians, this gives her the ability to do what? To open her hand to the poor and reach out her hand to the needy. As I read this passage, I thought, this woman is a true capitalist. And then I thought of my son Anthony, who thinks that capitalism has some real flaws, and I think it does too. But I think this woman demonstrates, you could be a capitalist without being greedy. You could be very capitalistic in your thinking and operate under sort of capitalistic principles of hard work and trying to find things that have value and selling and purchasing and do all of that in the context of an eye towards the needy, an eye towards the poor, an eye towards those you are responsible for, an eye towards your family. And that's what this woman is doing throughout. She is providing for so many people. Verse 21, she is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet. Now, we're not afraid of snow here. Let's be serious. But that's because we have furnaces in our house and wood stoves and we have insulation and all kinds of things. You know, in Israel, in the ancient times, snow meant cold and meant wet. And it's not surprising that she would be. I think people were pretty uncomfortable when snow came, because as you guys know this, you will freeze to death a lot quicker in about 30 degrees and wet than you will in 10 below and dry. And so there's a real danger when Israel would get snow. But this woman's not afraid of it. Why? Well, it tells us because her entire household, first of all, you know what it didn't say here? It didn't say because she is clothed. See, just very subtly, it tells us something about mothers. Mothers are not afraid for themselves. They're afraid for who? Their children. They're not afraid for them. So it doesn't even bring up the fact that she has clothing that will keep her warm. It says she is not afraid of snow for her household. For all her household are clothed in scarlet. Now, this is a tricky one, because this particular Hebrew word, when you take away the vowels, which came much later, we added the vowels much, much later to the Hebrew text, there's two different words this can mean, and both of them actually can make sense even if you don't think the first one does. One is the normal word for scarlet, okay? If it means scarlet, the idea is this. Scarlet was a very, very luxurious color dye. And consequently, it sometimes was used to refer to luxurious clothes. So the idea here would be is she's not afraid of snow because her household has quality clothing that will keep her warm. The other word that this could mean in Hebrew is the word double. Now you think, what do you mean? Double, because that's all it would be. It would be, you would read it this way, for all her household are clothed double. Well, we can kind of imagine what that might mean, right? They're wearing layers. We talk about it all the time. You want to stay warm? You wear layers. She has enough clothing for her household that they can layer their clothing. And that's why she doesn't worry about the cold. What is this really telling us about her, though? This is a prepared woman. This is a woman who prepares for things. She's ready for the uncertainties, and we see in a minute, even of the future. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. This is actually the center verse of the poem. By the way, if you didn't know this, and I don't know, maybe it would, if you have a study Bible, it'll tell you this. This poem is 21 verses long. There are 21 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. Each verse begins with a letter of the Hebrew alphabet in order. So the first verse begins with Aleph. The second verse begins with Beit, and then Gimel and Dal, and it goes through the entire. This happens a few times. It happens in Psalms 119, but there are a couple of poems that do this. It would be like if we wrote a poem and the first line we started with A, the second line we started with B, the third line we started with C. This is the center line of the poem. And in the center line of the poem, we find probably that which is something that is the most significant for the person giving it. Well, if this is a mother speaking to her son, we probably shouldn't be surprised that all of a sudden it focuses in on him. And it says, her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. He's known in the gates for what? For her. That's the implication. It's not that her husband's famous. No. It's that her husband's renown, he owes his renown to his wife. He owes it to this woman because of all the things that she does. It's like Ruth. Do you remember in the book of Ruth when Boaz asked about this woman that was in the field? She had already gained a reputation. The people of the land, men and women alike, looked at Ruth and said, wow, that woman is something. That's Naomi's daughter-in-law, and look at how she provides for her. She left her own family just to take care of one of ours, and look at how hard she works for Naomi. She had gained a reputation. There was already fame associated with her, and the same thing is going on here. This woman has brought renown not just upon herself or her family, but she's brought renown on her husband. And then the second half of the poem, which is a little shorter. She makes linen garments and sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchants. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. It really should have been translated, she laughs in the face of the future. She laughs in the face of the future. Guys, in the ancient world, that's pretty hard to do. Because in the ancient world, you just never knew if tomorrow would bring a raiding party and your family would be killed. But this woman lives with such trust in something that we haven't even been told about yet, such confidence that she is in the hands of someone else. And yes, she has taken the steps to provide and all those things, but she laughs at the future. Well, I said she's an ideal woman. A woman who laughs at the future is a woman who does not have worry. She doesn't struggle with anxiety. She's not worried about things for her family. She's not worried about her kids. You know, if we were all standing up and said, okay, all of you mothers out there who don't struggle with a little bit of worry sit down, you'd all be seated probably right now. Let's be honest. This is an ideal. She's the ideal. But this is the quality that I see in this woman. I think, wow. It's like when we look at Jesus and say he's sinless. Well, I'm not there. And I have a feeling that most women are saying, well, I'm not there. She laughs at the future. She has no concern. She does not worry about it. And let me tell you, there were real threats in this woman's future. There are real threats in an ancient world. And yet her confidence, it's coming from somewhere. So she goes on and says, she opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She is a teacher. Doesn't tell us who she instructs, but I think we can presume she instructs her family. And probably those who have noticed her and have found her a remarkable person. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. And there it is. This is where her confidence comes from. This is why she can laugh at the future. This is why she doesn't worry about snow. This is why, even in the end, she may work and do all these things. She's not putting trust in her own ingenuity to be able to provide for her family. Her faith is in the Lord. She fears the Lord. And remember, this is Proverbs. How does Proverbs begin? The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. How does Proverbs end? With a woman who fears the Lord. A woman who has attained a great deal of wisdom. And that wisdom has so benefited her family that all of the other things in this chapter that may have benefited her family does not compare to the wisdom that she can instruct them with because of her fear for the Lord. And she is to be praised. I think there's probably many mothers that have wanted to get their sons to understand charm is deceitful and beauty is vain. It's also fleeting. But a woman who loves Jesus, who trusts in him, who wants to live for him, well, that's a beauty that does not fade. And that goes a long ways in a relationship. Give her the fruit of her hands and let her works praise her in the gates. Not only do her children praise her, not only does her husband praise her, but her works, her life actually cries out like rocks. As Jesus says, if the people don't cry out in praise of him, the rocks will. Her very deeds speak praise to this woman. It's an ideal. But then again, Jesus is an ideal. And it's good to put ideals before us and say, this is who we want to be. This is the kind of person we want to be. We're going to fail in all kinds of these areas. But we want to be this kind of person. And just as I say, I want to be like Christ, where does that begin? It begins with putting my faith in Jesus. Because until I put my faith in Jesus, I cannot be like him in any of these ways. Well, some of you mothers and wives are looking at that passage and say, well, I'd like to be like that woman. Where does that begin? It begins with the fear of the Lord. It begins with the proper understanding of who God is in relationship to you and what he has given you. And yeah, it's an ideal. But you know what? It is an ideal that will be reached. Just as we will become like Christ, this ideal will be reached. We will become wise. Why? Because God is wise. Jesus is wise. And we're being conformed into his image. And If you say, well, I just am not there yet, I've got some good news for you. There is one prayer I know will be answered, the Bible tells me, for sure. It comes from the book of James. And what does it say? If you lack wisdom, ask for it. And what will happen? God will give it to you. As this woman is just the embodiment of wisdom. We men need to be like this woman. And this could have been written to men. That's not even the point. It was, in a sense, you know, it's a mother speaking to her son. But all of these qualities should be of men. We need to be wise. And the Bible tells us if we lack this, just ask for it, and God will give it to us. Let's stand. Let's close our service with this song we've been learning. And then I will pray. I want to pray for Mary, which is Donna's sister, and just a couple of the things, because we're not going to have our prayer and share time, because I want us to go and celebrate with our mothers. Let's sing this song, and then I'll close in prayer, but I want to lift up a couple of requests that I'm at least aware of. And please take your bulletin and be praying for